"This is my last time," says Rissing, "as someone who has studied science and the process of evolution for 25 years, to say that I perceive that my children and I are suffering injuries based on a flawed lesson plan that this board has passed." During a heated question and answer session, one board member accuses the scientists of posturing for me, the only reporter in the audience. Michael Cochran challenges the scientists to cite any testimony that the board hadn't already heard ad infinitum. Another board member, Deborah Owens Fink, declares the issue already closed. "We've listened to experts on both sides of this for 3 years," she says. "Ultimately, the question of what students should learn is decided in a democracy, not by any one group of experts." The notion is noble enough. In a democracy, every idea gets heard. But in science, not all theories are equal. Those that survive decades, centuries of scientific scrutiny end up in classrooms, and those that don't are discarded. The intelligent design movement is using scientific rhetoric to bypass scientific scrutiny. And when science education is decided by charm and stage presence, the Discovery Institute wins. And that was The Crusade Against Evolution by Evan Ratliff, the cover story of the October issue of Wired magazine.
We've lost our jobs and healthcare, praise our George. Lost civil rights and clean air, praise our George. In Iraq each day there is a new combustion. Destruction. Oh, we may suffer now in George we trust. We know the afterlife was made for us. George will find another nation ripe for capture. But war three, but first the diseases, second terms for George and Jesus.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fenner, Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, Free Radio Olympia 91.3, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KFAR Knoxville, and KRFP Moscow, Idaho 92.5. Next, how corporate rule paves the way for American fascism. Back to Mike McCormick as he interviews an author of a new book on regime change in America.
We are talking today with Charles Derber. He is professor of sociology at Boston College, and he is also author of the new book, Regime Change Begins at Home, Freeing America from Corporate Rule. Charles, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
If you could start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your new book, Regime Change Begins at Home?
I was walking in Boston, where I live. It was a peace march in the right before we went into Iraq, and I saw a sign that said, Regime Change Begins at Home. Had a laugh that night. Didn't sleep too well. Sort of thought about that idea, and I thought there was a serious idea behind that. And it was that... Well, let me introduce it this way. There's a joke going around that if you call the White House and ask for Mr. Bush, you get an answering machine which says, please leave your name, your number, and the country you want invaded, and we'll get back to you. And the relevance of that is that that's a good way of the Americans have learned to think about what a regime is. It's a bad government somewhere else, presumably in the Middle East or someplace that the United States wants to knock off. That night when I wasn't sleeping, I began to think about the idea of a regime in the American context and thinking about what it would mean to describe American life as subject to a regime. I went to Webster's dictionary. It said a regime was a system of power that exists in every country. And I somehow that night came up, which is usually the way my books get their initial birth. I thought there was an important idea here that you could rethink American history as a succession of regimes and regime changes. And so I basically got up that morning and thought there was something to explore here if one were to write about America today, the regime that's governing America today, and the kind of regime change that's necessary to get us out of our current problems.
Could you give us what the definition of a regime is?
Yes. I think we're living under what I call a corporate regime, by which I mean, one way to think about this is that what the newspapers show you every day are the sort of personalities bobbing on the surface of the water, let's say. You see a Bush, a Kerry, you know, the political party personalities, the media pundits and so forth. Underneath all that visible surface is a structure, a very dense, powerful structure, which is sort of the, and everything, the faces you're seeing on the surface are, have their feet planted on this structure. And that structure underneath the surface that the media never describes is what I mean by the regime. It's a system, an institutional, to use the academic phrase, a structural form of power, both economic and political and ideological, that pretty much guides the movement of everybody that you see on the surface. So both Bush and Kerry have their feet, if you were to go under the water, have planted on that same sort of structure, which I call a regime underneath. And that doesn't mean, as we'll, I'm sure we'll get into as we talk further, that there's no distinction between the two people. I think there is. And I personally feel it's important that we make clear what that distinction is and what the implications of electing Bush or Kerry is. But both are anchored, and both parties right now are anchored in what I call a corporate regime, by which I mean a system of power which takes more or less the form of a constitutional democracy with elections and the electoral procedures that we think about as related to democracy, but is actually, to be crude, a pseudo-democracy where the voting and the elections are producing outcomes that are pretty much determined by the large transnational companies that are the fundamental institutional foundations of the regime. And what I try to do in the book is trace American history since the Civil War and show that this isn't the first time that we've been governed by a corporate regime. There was one during right after the Civil War during the Gilded Age, the Rockefeller-Morgan period, when the first real period in American history when modern corporations came into being, gained great influence in America, took over much of Washington, and set the agenda for the country, creating enormous inequality and vast corruption of American political life 100 years ago. It happened again, what I call the second corporate regime, during the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, another period of enormous business domination of America. This was a period when what I call the second corporate regime introduced the religion of mass consumerism and where there was an ideology developed that's, you know, sort of reached into the present day. And then we had the New Deal, which was a regime of its own kind, but a very different kind of regime. And then, just to really telescope the history, when Vietnam War helped to bring regime change along with a very organized religious right movement in the South and a corporate, very, very cleverly sophisticated, heavily financed movement to restore corporate power in the late 70s. With Ronald Reagan, we got another regime change, which produced the regime that's governing America today. And as I say, what characterizes a regime, a corporate regime, is a domination of the country and of both political parties by corporate interests that are pretty much married to the political classes. There, what happens in a corporate regime is that the distinction between the economic elites and the political classes erode, and you get a kind of unholy alliance between the leaders of the transnational companies and the political elites, people like Bush, Cheney, and even Clinton, who represents a different sector of these elites, these corporate elites, essentially joining to a point that it becomes very difficult to distinguish the corporation from the government. They sort of become bound together by a thousand relatively visible to invisible threads. And they produce this monolith where corporations begin acting like governments and talking about social responsibility and governing much of running much of the healthcare and education and even military operations that you associate with government. And governments become businesses basically associated with helping the generation of profit at the well-being of ordinary people. And so that's what I mean by regime, a system of power that, in this case is global in character, is very scary because it's such a huge the global companies have become so large and the political elites have been so become so tightly aligned with them that it becomes very difficult to see how to make this whole system of power accountable.
I'm wondering if we can go into some more detail about the different corporate regimes that have occurred in this country and what occurred to displace those. If we could go back to the Gilded Age, did that come about by chance, or was that a grand plan behind that?
Well, somewhere in between. The first corporate regime, which rose up after the Civil War, came into being because of the Civil War, really. The Civil War created a powerful state, a federal state. It's interesting that the roots of corporations are always closely tied to the war. And the first robber barons, people like Jay Gould and other railroad barons, had got their money out of war profiteering during the Civil War, running guns and charging on both sides a lot of money to the governments, both the South and the North, generating funds. And they then developed, in that period right following the Civil War, you had 11 presidents up to Teddy Roosevelt, all of whom were sort of Bush-like presidents. They were corporate presidents. The only Democrat of the lot, a man very much like Bill Clinton, was a guy named Grover Cleveland, who served twice, and his inaugural statement said, the first thing he said was, big business has nothing to fear if I come into power. He also said at the point when, at the famous Homestead strike, a steel strike in 1894, when strikers pleaded with him to aid their cause because they were being killed by some company goons, he said, you might as well ask me to dissolve the government of the United States, that is to help come in and help, you know, side by the workers. So it was pretty clear at that point that even the one Democratic president during this period had been absorbed within what I call that first corporate regime, which was dominated by Rockefeller and Morgan and people like that. This was a very important period also. And what was happening, you said, did it happen by accident? What was occurring was that you were seeing new technology development. The sort of internet of the day was the railroads, and they were bringing the market together. Before the Civil War, corporations had been local and regional entities. There had been no real national corporations. So the railroads helped create the infrastructure for a national corporation, just as the internet today has helped create the infrastructure technologically for a global corporation, which is the key entity of the current regime. The other very significant factor of that first corporate regime was that in every regime, the constitution changes. One of the interesting aspects of a regime is that it creates very fundamental changes in the constitutional structure of the country. So that, for example, Yale legal theorist, a Yale Law School guy named Bruce Ackerman, has written that the United States has not had one constitution. It's had four or five constitutions. And each of these correspond roughly to the regimes I'm talking about. And during the Gilded Age, these Bush-like Republican presidents appointed Supreme Court justices who used the 14th Amendment, which was the amendment passed after the Civil War, presumably to protect freed slaves and protecting their resubjugation. It said that every citizen was entitled to due process under the law and to that you could not treat citizens unequally. It turns out that this constitutional amendment became the fundamental foundation for vesting corporations with legal rights as persons. A lot of people now know of the corporate personhood concept, which was a concept that developed during this first corporate regime when in a Supreme Court decision known as the Santa Clara Act of 1886, that came to be interpreted by later courts as for the first time affirming that corporations were legal entities that should be have constitutional protections, First Amendment rights, speech rights, which included the rights to give money to political campaigns, privacy rights, a whole set of rights, and most importantly, rights under the 14th Amendment, which essentially made it very difficult to challenge corporations, because any time you tried to prevent a corporation from doing something, it could claim that you were discriminating against corporate constitutional rights to whatever it is that you were trying to prevent corporations from doing. So the first corporate regime produced a system that is very familiar today, a system of great gaps between the rich and the poor. In 1890, 90% of Americans were poor. Rockefeller became the country's first billionaire. You had a lot of breaking of labor unions that were beginning to form then. You had significant economic growth, as you had in the 1990s here, but the overwhelming majority of the growth was being creamed off by the top 1% of the population. So it's just a window into our past, and that's one of the usefulness of thinking of regimes that is very interesting in thinking about today. Now, that regime came down in the late 1890s, and ultimately with the assassination of President McKinley and the coming into power of Teddy Roosevelt as a corporate reformer in 1901, when a progressive regime started. Now, and this will get important in our conversation, the regime change that occurred was triggered partly by contradictions emerging as corporations became large national institutions that the legal system of the first corporate regime was not prepared to manage, or the political system. It turned out they needed a large regulatory structure, a change in the whole organization of corporations and the government. You began to get financial tremors and serious economic recessions during the 1890s that threw a lot of people out of work, very similar today, a lot of problems that ordinary American working people were having. And the farmers of the time, who were the majority of the workforce, were also experiencing significant problems, economic problems. And this led to the rise of populism as a force in American political culture, and the creation in 1892 of the People's Party, which had a sort of Naderite flavor to it. It was formed in Nebraska, in the Midwest and the South in the early 1890s as a response to corporate power. And if you read the manifesto of that party, which took over the Democratic Party in 1896 and ran William Jennings Bryan against President McKinley, the guy who was elected, that was the first time where populist politics became very significant in the country and helped ultimately to bring about regime change. Even though the populists and the Democrats lost in that election in 1896, it laid the way for the progressive movement, which was a sort of a watered-down populism for which Teddy Roosevelt seized upon and helped to create a third party that would sort of run a moderate kind of corporate reform, but created significant structural change in the country, a kind of regime change that lasted from 1901 to 1921. So anyway, I think there's a lot to learn. It's been, I'm not the first to comment on this, about the parallels between the United States in the late 19th century and America in the late 20th century and early 21st century. They were both corporate regimes, periods of overwhelming business domination, coming together of big government and big business, and a kind of misery among the ordinary population that was struggling to keep afloat. And the rise of ultimately, I mean, the good news here is that what the first corporate regime showed was that ultimately these regimes are not capable of sustaining themselves, and they generate mass popular movements against their power, which tend to have a populist flavor to them. And as we'll see later on, as you go forward in history, these populist movements are not predictable, and they're not necessarily positive. I mean, there's a form of populism that can produce a more democratic and more egalitarian kind of economy, and there's a kind of populism that's increasingly grown significant, which gets appropriated by the right wing and develops a kind of proto-fascist direction. And I actually think that our current election, as our current corporate regime is going into crisis, can lead to a struggle between two forms of populism, one to the right that Bush and Cheney might orchestrate in a second term that would have a proto-fascist character to it, and one to the left that a lot of the social movements on the streets today would try to bring to Washington and try to push Kerry, if he were elected, in that direction, although Kerry right now is well anchored in the corporate regime and is not disposed to this kind of more positive populism.
Well, since you weave in the word fascist fascism into this, I'll ask you this now. There are many people that like to talk about, I believe it was Mussolini's quote, comparing corporatism and fascism.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that as a legitimate tie for the different corporate regimes that we're dealing
with? That's becoming a very important question, Mike, which I think a lot of people are starting, including me, to give serious attention to. The corporate regimes in the United States have not been fascist in the past. I mean, they've been national regimes. They have involved this character of an integration of big business and big government, which many people view as characteristic of fascist systems in Germany and Italy during the 30s. But they haven't created the total suspension of constitutional liberties and constitutional democracies that you're beginning to see a little bit of under the Bush-Cheney side of the regime today. There's a lot of confusion, I think, to understand what fascism is. If you think of fascism as the system that I think most people think of it as a system that developed in Germany and in Italy under Mussolini, Germany under Hitler, and trying to think about the relation between big business and fascism is a complicated subject. In Germany, Hitler developed really as a movement of the small business and sort of lower middle class groups that capitalism at the time were leaving behind, essentially, and were not providing for. And once Hitler got into power, the large businesses were more or less happy to join forces with him, but it hadn't been a corporate-inspired movement. So corporate regimes always have because they inspire – I think fascism can be understood as a kind of movement in response to serious regime crises, capitalist crises, corporate regime crises in particular, that tend to mobilize disenfranchised people, not necessarily working class people, small business people, lower middle class people who feel displaced, usually males, who look then for some sort of system that is going to reinstate their power, whether as part of a military force, you're typically in a religious or military context. And that is very often underwritten by corporate regimes. And particularly, I think today, because this is a global regime and increasingly depends on military power, both externally and internally, to maintain its legitimacy, I think there's a real danger today that the current corporate regime, more than earlier regimes, could take more what are considered classical fascist directions. I mean, the current regime emerged in the 70s as a union of corporate funding. In the early 70s, big business groups got together in a very powerful way. They founded the American Heritage Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, the Big Business Roundtable, a whole set of corporate institutions that have proved very significant in running the regime. And at the same time, you had concurrently an organizing of fundamentalist Christian groups in the South and the so-called red states today, but really all over the country, that were preying on the economic vulnerabilities and the spiritual anxieties of people in the country who were not being well served by the economic order. Now, when you bring together those two groups, that is, disenfranchised, as I say, particularly male workers or small business people, with a well-organized corporatized political structure, I think you do get the potential of a fascist kind of turn to the regime. So that I think the 2004 elections could be regime tipping in either way. If Bush is reelected, which is certainly a very distinct possibility, you could see a tipping of the regime toward this proto-fascist character. Increase the war on terrorism provides an umbrella for this. I think the state and the corporations are themselves mobilizing a kind of response of this kind, and then that can be heavily supported by not only by the orchestration of fear that Michael Moore talks about in all his films, but the kind of economic displacement. I mean, essentially, there's a kind of economic terrorism that many, many people in this country are experiencing. I mean, the data around job insecurity as jobs are outsourced and as union contracts are broken, as healthcare and just the housing becomes unaffordable for large parts of the population. as we're talking, I just read in the Seattle Times this morning the latest demographic data on poverty and on health care insurance and so forth, all of which are trending down. And actually, they showed trends for the last 10 years, but they're actually – these trends are pretty consistent for the life of the regime, which is about 30 years now, about since the late 70s. So you have a mass of population that is vulnerable to a fascist peel, and you have an elite, namely the sort of military sector of the corporate elite that Bush and Cheney represent, who are happy to go in that direction, whose instincts are violent and secretive. And so you have a brew there that's dangerous and I think really makes this election significant. And it's ironic because you might say, well, gee, this guy Derber is saying that both parties, both Kerry and Bush, are standing, have their feet planted in the corporate regime, so it doesn't make a dime of difference which one you elect. But it's more complicated than that because I think that if you elect Bush, the regime could tip, even in a direction that the corporations themselves are not totally comfortable with, toward this proto-fascist response. But like I say, there's an uneasy relation between corporatism and fascism, and they have connections that are important. But fascism can also be driven by a kind of right-wing populism that can get out of control of the corporations and produce extremely violent responses that that can make business conditions unstable and not particularly favorable for the corporate elite. So that's one possibility. It's a really frightening one. The other, if Kerry were to win, the hope is that you can since all corporate regimes, when they were in trouble, and we haven't talked about this yet, but in my book I try to show why I think this third corporate regime is in deep structural crisis. When a corporate regime is in structural crisis, you're going to either get a rightward populism or a leftward populism. So if Kerry is elected, there's a greater chance that the corporate regime will become essentially the target of more progressive groups with a more democratically oriented populism, like the populism that grew up in the 1890s. And that's the best hope right now, that if you elect a Democrat, for many reasons, it becomes possible for more progressive and left-leaning populist groups to challenge the corporate cast of the Democratic Party and to begin to bring sort of breathed life in that dead carcass that Kerry and some of the mainstream corporate Democrats represent and bring a new Democratic agenda to the country, really. And that's what happened. Remember, in the first corporate regime, the populists took over the Democratic Party. Yeah, they formed their own party in 1892, and then they actually took over the Democratic Party in 1896 and ran a populist campaign. So that's why I see this election as significant. You have a corporate regime that is very dangerous and very global and very violent now and very unstable financially and socially. And you're going to have a populist response to it. And the question is this response going to be guided by elites that are going to sort of shape it in a proto-fascist direction, or will it be a regime tip that allows more democratic and progressive groups to move the country in a to sort of challenge the corporate regime from the left? It's complicated stuff, and it's loaded. It's explosive. It's dynamite. We're in a very as I've been thinking more about them, you've sort of seized on the fascist elements of this. This is not a normal political era. I discriminate in the book between what I call normal politics, which are periods where the regimes are fairly stable and where you don't get a lot of change. There's not a lot of either on the upside or downside. And then you get these regime change eras where the regimes have become very unstable and you have a possibility of change, regime change, structural change that can be either very dangerous or very progressive. And those are very important periods for people like ourselves who are concerned with progressive change to be aware of and to try to figure out how do you mobilize all of the discontent in the country, and there is great discontent in the country, in a progressive direction when you're fighting a media and a political and military system that is using the war on terror to heavily move the country to focus on the sort of rightward possibilities of the moment.
I'm wondering if we can continue with talking about the history behind this, the different eras. The progressive regime, which had overturned the corporate regime of the Gilded Age, that went from
1901 to 1921. Exactly.
Why did that have a downfall? How did that get displaced?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, basically, Teddy Roosevelt, who was a bit of a militarist and imperialist, obviously, but also a corporate reformer and known as the Trust Buster, he put significant changes. He actually tried to create a Bureau of Corporations that would – some people regarded as socialist. He was not a – I should add, because in sort of fleshing out the history, regime changes are not revolutionary. Even when you move from a first corporate regime into the progressive era, you don't get a revolution. You still preserve capitalism. But you get a significant restructuring of power, significant reforms, some taming often of the corporate beast, as you saw in the New Deal, and to some degree in the progressive era, although the progressive era was complicated also because while corporations were subjected to a new regulatory structure in the progressive era, this was a regulatory structure that ultimately served the interests of the larger corporations. Regulation is now so tightly tied to the regulators. It's sort of like the fox and the chicken coop, the people who run the Food and Drug Administrations or the Federal Communications Commissions are the same people who come out of those industries and pretty much – so they're kind of a cosmetic gloss over the – and that began in the progressive era. So in a sense, the progressive era, while it created a new party, Roosevelt tried to create a new party, and then when World War I came, the Democrats joined up with this progressive – Woodrow Wilson was also a progressive. But it really – with the ending of the war, the progressive – ideology really fell into disfavor, I think, because it wasn't really bringing significant relief and change to the people. And after the war, corporations were in a position, you know, the economy was stimulated by the war, as I've mentioned before, the close connection between war and corporations. The end of World War I gave corporations a boost, in a sense, to sort of take back the country fully in the 20s, and you had three Republican, Bush-type corporate presidents, and you had a very financially driven corporate period in American history. A lot of relation, again, to the 1990s, a four-time boom in the financial part of the markets, a lot of corporate scandals like the Enron scandal or whatever, and the Teapot Dome scandal and other great business scandals of the 1920s. But that regime, while it introduced ideas of corporate responsibility and corporate paternalism as an effort to sort of, again, forestall unionism and sort of say, well, corporations can run the society. We don't really need government or unions or other community-based institutions. The financial markets crashed, of course, in 1929, and that led to an early aborting of this second corporate regime. Roosevelt came in 1932 and helped bring in regime change, but it's interesting to look at that regime change because Roosevelt came in as a Hooverist. He really, you know, his first effort was to sort of continue this idea that corporations would regulate themselves rather than having the government come in or having any kind of popular accountability. And what that shows you is that corporations are ultimately systems of thought control. They seek to sort of establish what are respectable and acceptable ways of thinking about society and politics. So Hoover's idea of laissez-faire was the great, along with consumerism, the great intellectual contribution of the age. And it so basically established the idea that was common sense of that second corporate regime, which was that corporations, government should stay out of the picture, there should be no labor unions. And Roosevelt came in a product of that regime. It took him a long time, and it took populist struggles by workers who were wildcat striking in the early 30s and tenant organizing among people who were being thrown out of their homes. This is in the earliest part of the Depression, to push Roosevelt from a kind of second corporate regime mentality to moving toward a real break, which meant a new way of thinking and a new form of politics, which the New Deal became. But it took several years. So regime changes happen slowly, partly because what a regime does is it shuts down the mind. It says the only way to be in the world is the way we know it of the moment. So that for today in our third corporate regime, if you go to people and say, we need a fundamental change in business and the economy today, people look at you blank and say, are you saying we're not going to have a Walmart or a Home Depot or a Microsoft? They can't imagine a world that is not dominated by the current trends, even if they don't like the way jobs are being outsourced or something. So one of the challenges of regime changes is to seed in people's mind, the sort of revitalization of the imagination, the idea that, that the world can exist in a different way. It's very hard, but it's encouraging when you look at this history, because every time things have gotten really tough for people, there has been regime change. And so we need to recognize that there is hope for genuine change in this kind of period when the structural basis of the regime begins to erode, as it did in the late 20s, and as it now is again now doing.
The New Deal regime, according to your book, went from 1929 to 1970.
Roughly. I'd say, you know, the New Deal was the greatest, longest regime. It was a regime in which Roosevelt helped legitimate unions, created a model of Social Security, helped build a countervailing systems of institutions against the big businesses. He didn't wipe out corporations, nor did he fundamentally transform their nature, but he put constraints on their political influence, and he helped build up alternative institutions like unions that could limit their power. Why the New Deal fell is an important question, and it began to erode actually in the 60s when Goldwater lost but won. I mean, he lost the election in a landslide to Johnson in 1964, but he broke up the New Deal coalition that tied the South to the, you remember, Roosevelt won elections four times in a row because he united a progressive group of labor and intellectuals in the North with a basically very conservative South. Goldwater split that strange coalition apart and pulled the South for the first time into the Republican Party camp. And that created the basis for the beginning of the organizing of a new right-wing populism led by religious revivalists and fundamentalists in the South who would link up with this new corporate effort in the early 70s that I described earlier, that the two, that is the religious grassroots populism, the right-wing populism of the right of the South, was coordinated and came together with these corporate mobilization groups in the 70s to create the Reagan Revolution and bring in the current regime. Now, if you ask why did the New Deal fall apart and make itself vulnerable to these kinds of challenges, I think there are a number of complicated answers to this. One is the Democratic Party really fell on its face. Instead of really pushing forward with a changes that would have pushed the New Deal further in the 60s, basically the Democratic Party turned against the movements that were trying to push it forward and led us into the Vietnam War. Remember, the Vietnam War came under Kennedy and Johnson, and the possibility of sort of pushing the New Deal into a great society that Johnson used to talk into a more comprehensive democratic and social security system for ordinary Americans was sacrificed to the war. And that gave rise to an economic crisis. You know, during the, in 68, the war was beginning, just like the Iraq War is contributing to today. The Vietnam War was beginning to erode the economic stability of the country, and you were beginning to get serious inflation. The country went off the gold standard for the first time, and you began to get significant economic problems that the New Deal regime was not able to resolve. And of course, you had the oil crisis in the Middle East and a variety of new competition coming in as Japan and Germany had reestablished itself that the country wasn't able to deal with under the New Deal order. So there was kind of a window left open for these right-wing populist groups in the South and the corporations themselves to restructure themselves in a global character under the name of global competition and to create this regime change, which sort of took place over a period of about 10 years and crystallized ultimately in the election of your governor, Ronald Reagan, who really was the architect of the current corporate regime. And Bush is really just a, if you say, who is George W. Bush? George W. Bush is really a reincarnation of Reagan. He represents, there have been four presidents of the current regime, Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, and Bush Jr., our current president. And the two, if you think again that metaphor of the personality sitting on the structure, their feet planted on the structure, George W. is really the son, not of George, but of Ronald Reagan. And Bush and Clinton were more similar in Bush Sr. and were more similar too. But, you know, they sort of speak from different parts of the regime but represent the same fundamental global interests. I mean, Clinton built up globalization as a means of servicing the interests of these same transnational institutions. He talked about, he got caught into the language and conversation. Remember, a regime establishes the conversation. And so globalization became part of the conversation. Clinton talked about the end of big government, the end of welfare. It was interesting that a conservative Republican like Dick Nixon, in the last parts but still under the New Deal, was proposing things like a minimum income for all Americans at the same time that Clinton, 20 years later, was talking about taking away welfare and any kind of guaranteed income for Americans. So a regime sets the terms of discourse in the country. Even for a Republican like Nixon, who was serving in the last part of the New Deal, his domestic agenda was more progressive than Clinton's agenda, who was captured by the corporate regime and proposed a domestic agenda that really followed on the corporate focus on eliminating social welfare, eliminating, quote, big government, a bit of a hypocrisy since the regime is all about big government. It's really all about how the government and public resources can be used to service the welfare of large corporations. And if you say, what is the American government today? It's not a government of, for, and by the people. It's become a huge apparatus to economically and militarily service the interests of transnational companies, period. It's become an unaccountable institution that does not represent ordinary people, but represents the interests of these transnational companies. And it's not an accident that you've got so many downward trends. I mean, since the beginning of the regime in the mid-70s to now, you've had basically stagnation for 90% of the population, very little improvement in the well-being. People have been able to maintain or slightly improve their lifestyle only by working about, they now work about a month longer than they did at the beginning of the regime. You have women working, two members of the household working at the same time. You have people using their credit cards to go deep into debt to try to stay even with where they are. So while it may not appear as people are driving SUVs and have four televisions that their lifestyle has declined under the course of this regime, the truth is that the security and the stability of the so-called middle-class lifestyle has become severely compromised. And for people toward the bottom, the data in the Seattle Times that was coming out this morning showed that actually the percentage of the poorest sector of the population of national income is at its lowest since the census started recording this. So you're seeing real pain at the bottom third of the income distribution. And it's not, like I say, it's not accidental, because the structure of this regime is to take the resources of public life and to redirect them from servicing the needs of ordinary people to servicing both the subsidies and for mining companies, pharmaceutical companies, running the foreign policy and the military policy that's going to allow these global companies to operate profitably, not just oil, but all kinds of other global companies to in different sectors of the economy to operate profitably abroad. So this is a systemic direction of the regime, whether it's Democrats or Republicans in power, and it's not accidental that the mass of American workers are being severely wounded, bleeding under the nature of this regime.
Is there any evidence to indicate that this third regime that we are currently in has learned from the prior two regimes and modified their strategies to, you know, offset their overthrow?
You would think so. But actually, I would say this is the most reckless and the least, I mean, I think the thing that characterizes this regime in contrast to earlier corporate regimes is that capitalism has survived and corporatism as a subspecies of that has survived largely because you've had capitalist elites, corporate elites, who have been willing to take short-term sacrifices in order to sustain, you know, sort of maintain the stability of the overall system. What you're seeing, I believe, in the current economic order is that partly because of the way the financial markets operate globally, they're very short-term, and partly because of the greed and the way corporate executives' careers are followed, which is they don't have long careers after they become CEO of one company. They don't go on to become CEOs of other companies generally. So they become very, they're sort of like athletes who don't have a long career history. They try to get as much as they can, whatever the cost to the company that they're operating on. So you got, for example, in Enron and Tyco and WorldCom, you got executives in all three of those companies. You had CEOs We're talking Enron, Tyco, and WorldCom, three of the big corporate scandals. You had executives pulling down about $330 million over those 3 years as their companies were going broke. And I see them, that as a, that's a lot of money, I mean, to give one person, and at a time when all your workers are losing their pensions and are losing, ultimately losing their jobs, and the corporations are going to go under. That's a metaphor for, I think, what has happened during this regime. The elites have lost, despite all the coordination that emerged at the beginning of the regime under the Business Roundtable and these other business organizations, they have lost either their interest or their motivation to maintain the system over the long term and keep it. And they're going for short term, very high levels of individual profit and gain. And they're losing, they're sort of ceding control as they're losing ideological control of the workforce. They're turning over ideological controls to the state and to the military. So when a regime becomes unstable, the best thing to do and the most efficient way to run a regime is to do it through mass media, you know, persuasion, advertising, consumerism. It's a more effective, cheaper, less violent, more stable. But businesses don't like violence because it increases business costs. But under the current situation, and because this regime is global and the first two weren't, you're getting resistance from outside the United States, obviously in the Middle East and now in Latin America with Chavez and in Brazil and Lula and Argentina, to the regime that's creating a need for more military forms of control. And I think what you're seeing almost is a giving up on the ideological front. I mean, who would think that Bush would have a chance of winning this election if there weren't a war on terrorism, if 9/11 hadn't happened, and up turning totally to the sort of iron fist. There's, you know, a regime always has a velvet glove and an iron fist. And under Clinton, the regime took on this velvet glove. Bush has taken it off, and you see under the velvet glove, you see the iron fist that W represents for the regime. It's not an efficient mode of control. It's costly. It's destabilizing for business. And that's, of course, this is tied to that scary idea of fascism that we had talked about earlier, that when you take off the velvet glove of the regime becomes unstable and it begins increasingly to rely on violence both abroad and at home against its own opponents. Then you get that danger of a kind of repression, authoritarianism, suspension of constitutional rights, and a feeding of this sort of right-wing populism among the disenfranchised groups that can be very frightening, that could produce really catastrophic results politically.
So you do focus in your book on solutions.
Yes.
For what we can do.
I do.
Can we talk about some of those?
Sure. Well, first, there's a hopeful message in what I'm writing because I'm arguing that while we're facing extremely powerful and dangerous regimes, there has always been regime change in the United States. There's never been a regime that's lasted more than about a generation. So it would take an enormous reversal of historical precedent to imagine that this regime would stay as it is for another 20, 30, 50 years. And all it would take, in a way, is for people to recognize how their own interests are being compromised by the existing structure. You don't have to assume any kind of utopianism or altruism on the part of ordinary Americans. All you have to assume is that they can see their self-interest clearly, and it would soon become apparent that this regime is not structured to serve the needs of ordinary Americans. It's set up to feed the profit appetites of these very large global companies, and very few people these days believe that, you know, when global companies profit, that's going to make them rich. It's going to make the executives rich, but it's not going to make ordinary Americans rich. So the hopeful message, first of all, just from the large historical analysis, is that this is a country of regime change. It happens, and very often it happens in progressive ways, as it did during the New Deal. The question then becomes what kind of, particularly in corporate regimes, you get resistance, popular resistance to the regime. It tends to take a populist flavor, as I said. It's not within. There are three sort of historical political traditions in America: liberalism, conservatism, and populism. The ones that have been successful in mobilizing resistance to corporate regimes have been populist, not liberal or conservative. That's why this bitter divide between liberals and conservatives in the current regime makes most people yawn and go to sleep, in a sense. I mean, they recognize there's all this bitter bickering between the Democrats and the Republican, and they know there are significant differences between the parties. But they also know that there are certain commonalities that the parties share. And that's why half of Americans don't vote and why there's a lot of cynicism about John Kerry and about the Democrats. And for reasons I've already described, which have to do with the dangers of corporatism becoming a more fascistic model in the United States, I think we need to work very hard. Washington's a swing state. I think hope that people put a lot of energy into trying to get Bush out of office, because I think if he's reelected, we're going to be facing the rear guard politics of our life, you know, trying to just hold on to the most basic rights and liberties that I don't want to go there. I don't want to see all of our energies tied up in retrograde struggles to keep the sort of fascist predators away from our bedrooms and our doorsteps. On the other hand, being from Massachusetts and having had John Kerry as my senator for the last 25 years, I know that John Kerry is not a regime changer. He's a corporate Democrat. He's well tied to Wall Street and to big money in his family and elsewhere, and he's a patrician capitalist. But so was Roosevelt. Now, he's not a Roosevelt, but there's at least a possibility under Kerry. Kerry could put the velvet glove on the iron fist, but I don't think it will work too well, because the regime is in this structural crisis that I've been describing, where large numbers of Americans are losing. They're slipping down the slope into the middle class stability that characterized unionized workers, with the loss of unions, with the outsourcing of jobs, with the depletion. Kerry's talking about building up the military. There's just a depletion of money. There are tremendous deficits that have been created by the regime. Basically, the government has gone pretty much bankrupt. And so there's going to be a populist response. Kerry is not going to be able to follow through without really significant structural change on some of his promises about rebuilding jobs and rebuilding the economy and health care for ordinary Americans. So I think under Kerry, there would be an opportunity for grassroots movements, and I've noticed plenty of them as I've been traveling around the country, particularly in places like Seattle. I just came from San Francisco and Portland, but there are many, many states around the country. You're seeing community movements and some stirring within the Democratic Party at the base of a real desire for not just musical chairs in the White House, but for some significant political change. Now, what the content of that change agenda is the critical question. And I mean, it's something that's going to come out of struggle. It's going to involve, in the first instance, resistance to this fascistic military form of the regime, and which means trying to essentially take a fundamental shift in U.S. imperial and foreign policy, you know, bring American forces back from the Middle East, get out of Iraq, begin to get hold of the extreme militarization, which includes the whole prison structure of the country domestically, as well as we saw that with Abu Ghraib and so forth. And then it involves moving on a domestic agenda that would fundamentally deal with the power of these global companies politically. I mean, we have to basically separate the corporations from the state, essentially take corporations and that out of politics, which is a lot more than just campaign finance reform and that kind of thing. It involves a whole set of changes in the structure and the rights that the corporations have accrued over three regimes. So one, for example, when a lot of communities are going after a Walmart or any kind of, you know, a mining company or a pharmaceutical company that is preventing people from obvious things like being able to get medical treatment at a reasonable price, go to Canada to get drugs and so forth. All these issues are going to get connected if people start sort of tying the dots together with issues like, again, regime change involves a change in thinking. So people are going to begin to ask the question, what is a corporation and what is it for and what is its political, what are the political rights? Should corporations have political rights? And some of this is beginning to emerge around struggles of corporate personhood, issues about whether corporations should have constitutional protections the way the Bill of Rights assures ordinary American citizens. Should they have First Amendment rights, which give them the right to participate in elections and give, you know, very large amounts of money to candidates and so forth? One of a whole series of questions about the rights of corporations and whether corporations should be understood as persons. And there's a movement around the country that probably has begun to get some attention in Seattle and in the Northwest around the issue of corporate personhood and whether corporations should be understood as legal persons. You can go see this film called The Corporation, a Canadian documentary, which explores this in very great detail, and I talk about it in my book in some detail as well. At the same time, I think that movement is connected, that is the movement about corporate personhood, which is a part of a regime change politics, with what you might call a new civil rights movement for workers in this country, both black and white and Hispanic. That is, this is a regime which exists and has used globalization as a means of essentially taking away the protections and the rights that developed under the new regime, under the New Deal for ordinary Americans. So rights to unions, rights to health care, rights to overtime, pensions, all the things that are being stripped away that you see right now need to be restored in a new kind of populist movement that's progressive and democratic. And the two movements, the ones to strip corporations of political rights and influence and the ones to restore ordinary workers with rights that are set out in international law and the UN Declaration of Human Rights and the rights of children, the rights of women, and so forth. These two movements have to converge because as these three regimes have cumulatively vested more rights in corporations, they have undermined the ability of workers and ordinary communities to reclaim their rights. So there's almost like a zero-sum game here, that by vesting more constitutional rights in corporations, you are essentially obliterating the rights of ordinary Americans to get their needs in the political process met and in the economic system heard. So I think that basically you're going to see a tremendous revival of, if a Kerry is elected, of a struggle for the soul of the Democratic Party and a proliferation of third party at the state and local levels where, you know, I mean, the Democratic Party may, you know, parties don't last forever. It could become, if it doesn't respond to the needs, which are very powerful of ordinary people, to the social needs of the period, and if Kerry proves to hang on to his corporate identity, you could get a real destabilization of the Democratic Party and the beginning, as you did in the first corporate regime, of new party formations or severe fractions, you know, fractionalization of the Democratic Party about in a sort of new war for where the Democratic Party is headed. So it's not going to be an easy period, but because the regime is structurally bankrupt and is not capable of meeting the needs of people here or people abroad, you know, it's worth noting that because this regime is the first genuinely global corporate regime, those of us who don't feel it's serving us well are have allies abroad. And they may, in fact, I mean, when I've been abroad talking about these issues, one of the first questions people ask is, why can't we vote in your elections? Because we are affected more by who your president is and your companies than we are by our own president and our own companies. And ironically, there's a despair among many Americans, as I've gone around talking about these issues, who say, and I've never heard this before in my lifetime, who say, I want to leave. I want to get out of this country. I don't, you know, particularly the contemplation of another 4 years under Bush is terrifying to a lot of people, understandably. And it's interesting to put that instinct, which is to leave. In fact, there's a book by Randall Robinson, the Trans-Africa America Institute in Washington. He wrote a book called Quitting America, and he did leave in his 60s and wrote a book about it. That's a sentiment that's very widely shared. My own response is, well, just as those people were telling me that why they can't vote in our elections, you can't leave America. America is everywhere at this point. The regime is global. And so we have a responsibility as people with relative privilege still in the belly of the beast, you know, and people around the world are looking to us to help take leadership in this struggle. So it's a global struggle now. In the extreme forms, it takes the form of terrorism. It takes, fascist formations in the third world can take terrorist forms, but you're going to get a tremendous variety of different forms of resistance to the regime. Better that it take a nonviolent and progressive form than it take a violent and extremely destabilizing proto-fascist kind of response, which remains very possible, I think, in this country.
We've just been talking with Charles Derber. He is professor of sociology at Boston College, and he is in town to talk about his new book, Regime Change Begins at Home, Freeing America from Corporate Rule.
And that was Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio in Seattle. Thanks to the Christmas Coup Comedy Players for Praise Our George. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.